You're listening to The Globalist, first broadcast on the 10th of April 2024 on Monocle Radio. The Globalist, in association with UBS. Hello, this is The Globalist, broadcasting to you live from Midori House in London. I'm Georgina Godwin. On the show ahead, Joe Biden and Fumio Kishida are meeting in Washington to maintain and strengthen relations between Japan and the US. We'll examine their agenda. Turkey is restricting exports to Israel, but how much of this is really about Erdogan's domestic agenda? We'll have more from Ankara. In Russia, military wives and mothers are using their saucepans to send a message to the government. But will the Kremlin listen to kitchenware? Plus,
more than 30 years of work on the development of accelerators, detectors and computer programs have culminated in the discovery claim made by CERN in July 2012.
You may not know much about particle physics, but you will have heard of Higgs boson. We'll look back at the life of Peter Higgs, who made the scientific breakthrough. We'll have a roundup of business news, a flick through the international papers, and lastly, we'll hear who's made the shortlist for the highly prestigious International Booker Prize. That's all ahead here on The Globalist, live from London. First, a look at what else is happening in the news. Russia and Kazakhstan ordered more than 100,000 people to evacuate after swiftly melting snow swelled mighty rivers beyond bursting point in the worst flooding in the area for at least 70 years. Arizona's top court has revived a ban on nearly all abortions, further restricting reproductive rights in a state where terminating a pregnancy was already barred at 15 weeks of gestation. And Vietnam aims to start building two high-speed railway lines linking its capital Hanoi with China before 2030. Do stay tuned to Monocle Radio throughout the day for more on those stories. Now, Japanese Prime Minister Fumio Kishida and US President Joe Biden are having a summit meeting this week aimed at shoring up the alliance between the two countries. Meeting in Washington, the two leaders want to keep the momentum of the bilateral relationship going and forge a global partnership, all whilst keeping a wary eye on China. Well, I'm joined now by Julie Norman, who's the co-director of University College London's Centre on US Politics, and on the line from Tokyo by Tomohiko Taniguchi, who's a former special advisor to the cabinet of Shinzo Abe. Tomohiko, I wonder if we could start with you. Kishida outlined his aims before leaving Tokyo. What did he say?
He said the traditional and time-honoured alliance relationship between the United States and Japan is now supposed to serve greater purposes of maintaining international order that is based on rules. And he is going to call the alliance global partners for the future. And this for the future means a wide range of issues.
Such as
shouldering the responsibilities that have been traditionally covered solely by the United States. I think he's going to call the United States a partner with which Japan is willing to work for the public goods that the United States, again, traditionally has chosen to shoulder by themselves, knowing and being aware that mounting challenges make it imperative for Japan to work more closely with the United States. The United States cannot solely alone provide public goods to the international community.
Julie Norman, if I could come to you, how would you characterize the relationship between Japan and the US?
Sure. Well, obviously, this has always been a strong alliance. But what we're seeing now is really a major strengthening. You know, our eyes have been somewhere elsewhere in the world, but this is really a significant development in Asia right now to have Japan shifting in terms of its defense spending, in terms of its investments into defense. And the U.S. is very interested in that. They want this alliance to stay strong on defense, on security. And of course, we'll also hear a lot about economic and tech cooperation today, too. But I think defense defense is really going to top the agenda in light of growing threats from China, from North Korea, and to some degree from Russia as well.
Mm. Tomohiko, how's it being viewed back in Japan? What's the idea of the summit there?
The stones have been laid previously by the late Prime Minister Shinzo Abe, who called the alliance for Alliance of Hope, meaning that the United States and Japan must work more closely for the betterment, for the future of the world. So it's natural extension, and there has been very little deviancy from between the opposition and the ruling parties when it comes to the salience and importance to be put on the U.S.-Japan alliance. But the challenge for the Prime Minister is it's not going to be necessarily translated into the greater popularity that he could enjoy from the domestic voters.
Mm-hmm. And I wonder, Julie, what the best possible outcome for this would be from Biden's perspective, not just with the relationship with Japan, but also for his domestic base.
Sure. So there's a couple of things in place. One, I would say, is it is a big deal that this is an official state visit, official state dinner, a congressional address. So in terms of just showcasing, I would say, a very positive foreign policy relationship, that's very helpful for Biden. I would say on the economic side, there's some more political touchy elements in terms of, a Japanese steel company trying to buy U.S. steel. That's politically kind of testy for Biden right now. So there's some of those conversations that I think will be a little bit more on the sidelines than the official conversations. But for Biden, they do matter. And they're things that other Americans, I think, will be looking to, especially Republicans and GOP and Biden opponents. Mm.
Tomohiko, I wonder how this meeting fits in with Kishida's greater foreign policy aims.
He's been following basically what his predecessor has chosen to follow, namely to bring Japan on the center stage of the international community, again, being aware that the international order, especially in the Indo-Pacific area, has been constantly challenged by revisionist authoritarian regimes from Russia, North Korea to China. And the aims that Kishida is after during this summit meeting are, once again, pretty much the natural extension of what he has been doing.
Mm. So let's just pick up on defense, as you've been also speaking about, Julie. We know that on Thursday, Kishida will join Biden and the Philippine President Ferdinand Marcos Jr. to discuss the Chinese Coast Guard aggression in the South and the East China Seas. So tell us more about that focus on defense.
Yeah. So again, defense will, I think, play a part in the bilateral as well as in this additional meeting with the Philippines. Japan has over the last several years been increasing defense spending, has restructured their security strategy. And there's a couple of key things the U.S. and Japan will be discussing. One is just greater coordination between their different troops in Japan. The U.S. has about 50,000 service persons stationed there. They'll be talking a lot about new initiatives for defense industry, for defense equipment, for arms sales and these kinds of things, which is a new area of conversation for these two countries, and also possible participation in other security partnerships. And that certainly includes the Philippines, with both Japan and the Philippines, at least from the U.S. perspective, again, being somewhat subject to this increasing aggression from China, from aggression in the Pacific region, and trying to just shore up deterrence at the end of the day.
Mm. Tomohiko, speaking about military partnerships, I mean, there were suggestions that Japan might join AUKUS, that's the bilateral security partnership for the Indo-Pacific region between Australia, the United Kingdom, and the United States, JAUKUS, if you like. I wonder how likely that is and where it would sit within the Japanese pacifist constitution.
I think it's become much, much likelier. Certainly, Japan is not going to be able to provide nuclear-powered submarine fleet to Australia, which they call Pillar 1. But Pillar 2 includes a lot of initiatives, especially on the high technology areas, where Japan could contribute to the enhancement of Royal Australian Navy's capacity, by extension, the overall capacity of the naval powers of the United States, Australia, Japan, and the United Kingdom, which has, over the last couple of years, being very close militarily to Japan.
Right, right.
And to answer your question, given the impending crises that Japan is faced daily, coming from China, most notably, there is a wider recognition among the Japanese populace that more to be done, more should be done to beef up Japan's defense and deterrence capacities.
Julie, we know, of course, there's an election coming up in the United States soon, and of course, everything might change. How much can the Biden administration do to make sure that defense agreements that are put into place now are actually Trump-proofed, if you like?
Yeah, it's a good question. And I think it's one that both allies and adversaries are aware of about many of the agreements that are perhaps made under the Biden administration may not last, at least not last in their current form under a new presidency, and especially under Trump. With that said, you know, some of these relationships, and especially the one with Japan, I do think will be a solid alliance, even under a potential Trump presidency. One area where the parties do agree is on being somewhat tough on countering China. And I think both parties see bolstering this relationship with Japan as part of that overall aim. Again, some of the details may differ, but this idea of seeing Japan as a strong ally, as a strong partner, at least on the defense side, is something that I think would continue.
Mm. But Tomohiko, so far, Tokyo has tried to keep trade measures against China low key. Clearly, Japan doesn't want to antagonize its top trade partner. Will Biden seek to change that? How can it be achieved whilst keeping the status quo?
The Japanese companies are, as you say, very much concerned about the repercussion to be coming from China in response to the retaliatory measures taken by the United States and Japan. But silently but steadily, more and more Japanese companies are reshoring their operations, divesting from China and investing into its own country, its own homeland country. Remember that the Japanese currency is extremely cheap, and labor cost and everything has become much, much more competitive in Japan, even compared to China. So economically, it makes a lot of sense to move the production bases from China to Japan these days.
Mm. Tomohiko, thank you very much indeed. I understand that both leaders will be serenaded by Paul Simon at an official dinner. Julie Norman, Tomohiko Tamaguchi, thank you very much indeed. This is The Globalist.
UBS has over 900 investment analysts from over 100 different countries.
Over 900 of the sharpest minds and freshest thinkers in the world of finance today.
To find out how we could help you,
contact us at ubs.com.
It is 9:13 in Ankara, 7:13 here in London. Turkey has announced it's placing export restrictions on goods going to Israel until such time as a ceasefire is declared. As well as calling for an immediate ceasefire, Ankara has supported steps to try Israel for genocide and sent thousands of tons of aid for Gazans. Well, I'm joined now by Victoria Craig, who's a journalist based in Ankara. Good morning to you, Victoria. These trade restrictions came into place yesterday. Was there a particular incident that prompted them?
Good morning. There's been several reasons why President Erdogan and his government may have pursued something like this, sort of a push and a pull. I think the one thing that the Turkey's foreign minister cited was that Israel denied a request from Turkey to airdrop aid into Gaza. And you mentioned how much Turkey has sent. So this has been something that Turkey has been really passionate about since the conflict began back in October. They've been really rallying on the side of Gazans and Palestinians. And so that was what sort of prompted this response by Turkey. Turkey's foreign minister vowed retaliation in a press conference on Monday night and said that there's no excuse for Israel to block our attempt to airlift aid to starving Gazans. But there are also several domestic factors as well. There were local elections here in Turkey last weekend, and President Erdogan's ruling AKP party, the Justice and Development Party, lost in many provinces. Lots of people here saying that they wanted to see more actual action on Israel rather than just tough talk. So these two factors, I think, were probably the biggest in sort of pushing Turkey to this response.
And how much trade has Turkey traditionally done with Israel?
Well, it's been one of both, on both sides, both countries are big trading partners with each other. Last year, Israel was Turkey's 13th biggest export partner. And for Israel, Turkey is its fifth largest import partner. So since the war began in October, Turkish exports to Israel fell by about 30%, but it's still a major trade ally. And we can't forget that relations between Turkey and Israel had been cooling in recent months. It was only in September of last year that President Erdogan met on the sidelines of the UN General Assembly in New York City with Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. And many had called this a major milestone meeting. Tensions had been mounting for more than a decade over disputes over policies that pertain to Palestinians. And the two leaders had then agreed to meet in each other's countries when they called soon back then and beef up economic links, including in energy. But October 7th really put all of that on hold and on ice and really ratcheted up tensions, putting this thaw in relations really on the back burner.
Mm. So what specific goods will now be banned?
Well, there are 54 goods on the list, but there's importantly no details by how much Turkey plans to restrict any of these exports to Israel. But some of those exports include steel products, cement, granite, construction machinery, aviation fuel, things that Turkey thinks could be used in Israel's war efforts. The foreign ministry said in a statement when it announced those restrictions that the decision, as you said, will be in place until Israel declares an immediate ceasefire in Gaza and allows sufficient and uninterrupted humanitarian aid to Gaza. And then President Erdogan released a video later in the day yesterday, and he said that Turkey has shown that we stand by the Palestinian people in these difficult times. He said Turkey has sent more than 45,000 tons of aid to the region and vowed to continue to support the Palestinians until the bloodshed in Gaza stops. So we may see a ratcheting up of these trade tensions. Israel has, for its part, vowed to respond in kind, and it has called on U.S. companies to stop imports from Turkey to try to, further increase the blow to Turkey's economy. The foreign minister on X yesterday said that Erdogan is again, he said, sacrificing the economic interests of the people of Turkey for his support of Hamas, which Turkey doesn't consider to be a terror organization like many other countries around the world does.
Just unpick that for us, because Turkey is a NATO member. As you say, they don't consider Hamas to be a terrorist organization. What's the relationship?
Well, there are lots of allegations that members of Hamas are in Turkey and that President Erdogan isn't making any moves to do anything about that. There have been many pro-Palestinian marches and rallies across this country. They, of course, not directly related to Hamas, but it sort of gives you a picture of how much people here support the Palestinian cause and movement. And like I said, with local elections here last weekend, many people said that the president wasn't doing enough to support Palestinians and Gazans particularly. And like I said, President Erdogan doesn't consider Hamas to be a terror organization. He's called them a liberation group. In the immediate aftermath of October 7th, he made allegations that that Israel was committing a genocide. He's called Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu a murderer. So they really stand on two very different sides of this issue. And President Erdogan, I think, feeling the pressure from people here in Turkey to do more to actually respond and show more support rather than just support of words.
Mm. And so going forward, what will this signify for Turkey-Israel relations?
Certainly no rush in this effort to better relations, that's for sure. Like I said, President Erdogan has not been shy about calling Benjamin Netanyahu, quote unquote, the butcher of Gaza. He held what he called the Great Palestine Rally last year to sort of drum up support for Gazans. Thousands of people attended. But many told me that what they really wanted to see was more action from Middle Eastern countries to help those in Gaza, whether through more aid or immigration. And I think the other thing, too, is President Erdogan has sort of seen this as potentially an opportunity when Western support for Israel may be waning. We saw yesterday the UK said that it won't block arms sales to Israel, but France had floated the idea of sanctions to get more aid into Gaza. So President Erdogan may see this as an opportunity to sort of get some of Israel's Western allies more on his side. But certainly this doesn't seem like an opportunity to sort of repair a relationship or build any bridges between the two countries. But I think the real action will be in seeing how much Turkey does in fact restrict any of these exports to Israel. Because like I said, no specific amounts had been announced with this announcement yesterday. So we'll have to wait and see what the trade data actually show happens and how much, you know, Israel will respond with its own trade restrictions. Like I said, it's been trying to rally support with some of Turkey's allies, NATO allies, to restrict its own trade between the two countries. But those are really complicated relationships, and it's not clear how the U.S. will respond to that encouragement, I suppose, from Israel as well.
Victoria, thank you. That's Victoria Craig in Ankara, and this is The Globalist. Well, back to Turkey and back to the Middle East, because we're going to continue now with today's newspapers. And joining me down the line from Istanbul is Ruth Michelson, who's a journalist and Middle East correspondent. And in fact, Ruth, we want to start by looking at the latest on the war in Gaza. Tell us about where we are on ceasefire negotiations.
Well, the prognosis at the moment on ceasefire negotiations is not particularly positive. The latest news being that Hamas have said that they are reviewing the latest ceasefire proposal that was discussed in Cairo, that was presented by mediators there before leaving Cairo. And a senior member of Hamas told the Washington Post that talks were on hold. And the Washington Post basically going through the kind of ups and downs that have happened with these talks, that we've seen the Israeli Foreign Minister Israel Katz saying earlier this week that the negotiations have reached a critical point. But Hamas saying that the terms that were presented to them on the table in Cairo were essentially nothing new. And another senior spokesman from Hamas, Bassem Naim, talking to the New York Times, describing this latest proposal as worse than the previous ones, and saying that many of the things that were put on the table in Cairo this time were actually not as good, or they were less than what was previously offered.
Mm. And how are the papers covering the fact that there does seem to have been a bit of a sea change here from Washington?
Well, widespread coverage of Joe Biden's remarks towards Benjamin Netanyahu. We've been covering for a long time the kind of increasing public pressure from Joe Biden on Benjamin Netanyahu, in public criticism of his style of governance. And this seems to have reached the latest peak. So in an interview with Univision, which has been widely quoted, The Guardian, France 24, running these comments, saying that Benjamin Netanyahu's approach on Gaza was a mistake, in the words of Joe Biden, and saying, "I don't agree with his approach," and demanding an immediate ceasefire.
Mm. And I mean, this does mark a significant shift from his previous comments.
That does. I mean, certainly if we look at how Biden was talking at the beginning of the war on Gaza, and that in the beginning there was certainly a lot more kind of hedged criticisms of Netanyahu's choices. But now we're seeing a lot more kind of open discussion, particularly when it comes to the approach to aid. So he basically said that Israel should let more aid into Gaza. And he said that he'd spoken to leaders in Saudi Arabia, Jordan and Egypt, that they were prepared to move food in. And he said, "There's no excuse not to provide for the medical and food needs of those people. It should be done now."
But of course, things are about to get much worse. Benjamin Netanyahu has said that a date has been set for a ground military operation in Rafah. I don't think he's actually said when it is, but there's been widespread condemnation of this.
Absolutely. I mean, this has, you know, provoked understandably huge concern, given that there is over a million people considered to be in the city of Rafah in southern Gaza. Netanyahu has said There is a date described by Al Jazeera as doubling down, saying that Israel will proceed with its goal of eliminating all of Hamas's brigades, including in Rafah. And extremely forceful comments from Benjamin Netanyahu, literally saying there is no force in the world that will stop us.
Let's go to a good news story. It's a group of older Swiss women. They've won a landmark ruling at the European Court of Human Rights. It's declared that the Swiss government violated the right to life of its citizens by failing to do enough about the climate crisis. Now, this really is a landmark ruling. Tell us more.
Yes, been hailed by the lawyers. Comment that fought this case as a historic ruling. I think it certainly does have the power to reverberate across Europe. So this is a group of Swiss senior women, average age 73, called the Klima Seniorinnen, and they brought this ruling in, or brought a case to in the court in Switzerland, saying that the country had failed to reduce its greenhouse gas emissions fast enough to meet its own targets. Switzerland didn't respond to this case, and they escalated it to the European Court of Human Rights, which ruled in their favor. And so it's, according to the Washington Post, shows how governments can potentially be held to account in court for climate-related issues and could influence similar litigation worldwide.
Mm. Although there were a couple of other cases heard on the same day. Six Portuguese youngsters were bringing a case, as was a former mayor of a French coastal town. Both of those thrown out.
Yeah, I think there was some, the impression from lawyers that were speaking to the press was that they wanted all three cases to pass in kind of one big sweep to demonstrate the power of this kind of climate change legislation, or legislation to fight against government inaction on climate change, rather. The case brought by these six young people in Portugal is particularly interesting, all born between 1999 and 2012. And they basically argued that the existing and future effects of climate change, particularly looking at the spate of heat waves and wildfires that have hit parts of Central Europe, exposed them to harm. The court essentially said that because their case was brought against every member state that is a member of the European Court of Human Rights, that it was inadmissible, and threw the case out.
Right. And of course, the French mayor, I think, lost his case because he's no longer the mayor of that town. He was worried because the town is on the coast, it's very low-lying, and of course, there's a risk of flooding there. And well, people might worry about water in France. We're looking at a story now where a water charity in Paris has very bad news for the upcoming Olympics. They've been testing the water in the Seine, and it's not great.
Yes, extremely concerning news for the upcoming Summer Olympic and Paralympic Games. So this water charity, the Surfrider Foundation of Europe, said a shadow looms over the quality of the water in the Seine River. They found alarming levels of bacteria in the river, including E. coli. They tested the water around the Alexandre III Bridge, which will be the starting point for the Olympic and Paralympic triathlon and marathon swimming events, the centerpiece of the Olympic Games, and essentially said that there are, you know, these alarming levels of bacteria and E. coli in the water. Lots of mention of the idea that increased rainfall might also basically counter efforts by the mayor of Paris to clean up the River Seine, but also lots of statements given to the local media by the mayor of Paris, essentially saying, no, we're doing the cleanup operations. Everything will be fine in 100 days' time when these events start. But the piece in CBS, for example, shows a picture of a test event for swimmers diving off the bridge into the water that happened last year. So potentially some of these athletes have already been exposed to whatever's going on in the water.
Mm. So any chance that it might have to be cancelled?
There has been some discussion, certainly questions to the president of the Paris 2024 Olympics, Tony Estanguet, who basically said that the triathlon competition could be delayed, the swimming leg could be cancelled, and that would be due to adverse weather conditions, so increased rainfall. But he basically said, you know, this It would only have to be probably pushed off by a few days, and that swimmers are very tough. If you're a competitive swimmer, you're used to this sort of facing these kinds of difficulties.
Let's end with this wonderful story from Germany. I feel extremely sorry for this man who has been fired from a German art gallery. Tell us more.
Well, I mean, it's one way to make sure that your work gets into a museum, which is to go in there and hang it yourself, especially if you are part of the technical team at the Munich Art Museum, the Pinakothek der Moderne. And so there was a technician and, in the words of The Guardian, aspiring artist, and actually I think in the words of the Süddeutsche Zeitung, which is from Munich, talking about this man's artistic ambitions. And apparently earlier this week, the museum said that it had fired a member of its technical services team who managed to hang his painting in the gallery near Andy Warhol for an entire day. And a spokesman from the Pinakothek told The Guardian, the employee considers himself an artist and most likely saw his role in the museum's installation team as a day job to support his true calling.
Well, yeah, I've scrolled through various links to this and I cannot see a picture of his painting. Have you seen? Is he any good?
Unfortunately not. There doesn't seem, it seems like the museum didn't want to give him any more publicity by saying that he had a painting. But there was also mention in Süddeutsche Zeitung that there was another museum in Bonn where this happened, where the museum did react rather favorably. So this is the Kunsthalle in Bonn. Somebody came into the museum and a student who smuggled one of her own paintings into the museum and attached it to the wall with double-sided tape, they mention. And the Kunsthalle said, we think this is funny and would like to get to know the artist. So get in touch. There will be no trouble.
How fantastic. Ruth, thank you very much indeed. Now, here's what else we're keeping an eye on today. Russia and Kazakhstan ordered more than 100,000 people to be evacuated after swiftly melting snow swelled mighty rivers beyond bursting point in the worst flooding in the area for at least 70 years. The snow melt is an annual event in Russia, but scientists say climate change has made flooding more frequent worldwide. Arizona's top court has revived a ban on nearly all abortions under a law from 1864, half a century before statehood and women's suffrage, further restricting reproductive rights in a state where terminating a pregnancy was already barred at 15 weeks of gestation. President Joe Biden called the Arizona ruling the result of the extreme agenda of Republican elected officials who are committed to ripping away women's freedom. And Vietnam aims to start building two high-speed railway lines linking its capital Hanoi with China before 2030, another sign of a recent warming of ties between the two communist-ruled neighbours. Trade between Vietnam and China in the first quarter of this year rose 22%, though the two countries remain embroiled in a years-long maritime dispute in the South China Sea. This is The Globalist. Stay tuned. Now, a movement in Russia formed by the wives of soldiers has started a regular protest calling for their husbands to be allowed to return home. Joining me in the studio now is Stephen Diel, who's a Russia analyst and a regular Monocle contributor. Stephen, welcome back to the studio.
Good morning, thank you.
Tell us about this movement.
It's called The Way Home, Put Domoy in Russian. They have a very active Telegram channel, Telegram being the social media of choice for many Russians. And it started some months ago with the idea not so much to stop the war, although some of them clearly feel that that would be the best solution for Russia and Russians, but actually to bring home their husbands principally, but also brothers, cousins, uncles, fathers, who were called up under the mobilization announced by President Putin in September 2022 and have never been given leave. So we're talking about more than 18 months now. They've been at the front. They were not regular soldiers. They may have had a little bit of training, but none of them have been allowed home. And so that was what sparked off this movement. And for some months, women have been putting on a white headscarf and at 12 o'clock local time going to their local memorial to the unknown soldier. The main one, of course, is in Moscow, just under the Kremlin walls. But they're across Russia in other cities. and laying flowers. And that was the form of protest. And they've now decided to take this one step further. As of last Saturday, and they're calling for every Saturday, at 5 o'clock on local time, for people to go out on their balconies, or if they're at their dacha, go in the garden of their dacha, and bang saucepans. So they're calling it the March of the Empty Saucepans. Hmm. And on last Saturday, at least 20 cities and areas across Russia, women took part in this. Some men took part in this as well. On their Telegram channel, there are various videos that people have sent in. This, of course, is a brave thing to do. It's a demonstration, but they're saying, well, you're at home. Surely the authorities can't arrest you for doing something on your own territory.
Well, we know the authorities can and will do exactly as they like in Russia. So why is the Kremlin leaving them alone?
That's a very good question. My own feeling is that they're wary of these women, and they're wary of the numbers of them. We're talking thousands. Let's keep it in perspective. We're not talking millions of people across the country yet. But nevertheless, when you've got thousands of women who are making a protest, they're perhaps slightly more wary of arresting women, particularly en masse, than they would be arresting men. And there's this feeling that, how do we blame them or say they've committed a crime when all they're doing is either wearing a white headscarf and putting flowers or banging a saucepan? And I think that this is a reflection of President Putin's biggest fear in Russia. His biggest fear, as I've said in this studio before, is not nuclear war. It's not NATO. It's an uprising from below. And when you've got women whose husbands haven't returned, maybe are never going to return because they've already been killed, there's a feeling that they've got nothing to lose. And these women, as we saw in the Afghan war, when a lot of mothers protested and started a real social movement of soldiers' mothers, when they feel that they've lost what's most precious to them, and they say, what the hell, my husband's dead, my son's dead, what else have I got to lose? They will fight. Russian women have this reputation for being incredibly tough. Mm. And I think that is what is preventing the Kremlin from really pushing hard on them, because it could then spark out of control. And then if you get what the Russians call bunt, this uprising from below, that's what frightens Putin most of all.
And are these women anti-patriotic? Are they against the war?
They very much say that they are patriotic. You do get comments coming back to them on Telegram accusing them of being unpatriotic and using terms that one wouldn't repeat on the radio. But on the whole, they say, no, we're patriotic. What we're asking for is our government to fulfil its obligations. It's just not right to call men up to the army if for whatever reason and then not give them any leave. As I say, that's the starting point is that they're protesting about their loved ones not being allowed home at all for leave, which is in any circumstances very unusual. I mean, in the Second World War, for example, armies were allowed to have soldiers go on leave for R&R, rest and recuperation. But this is not happening at all. And also, of course, we know how brutal the Russian army is being to its own people. Mm. Soldiers who've refused to fight, maybe they've got PTSD, they simply cannot go on, are being thrown into a pit and not fed until they agree to come out and go and fight. The Russians have done some incredibly dreadful and brutal things to Ukrainians in Ukraine and torture and mass rape and so on. But they're actually very cruel to their own people too. And so this is what the women also are saying. Why should my husband be thrown into a pit because he's been on the front line for 18 months and just needs a break?
We know that Russia's desperately short of troops, but what might be the other reasons for not allowing them leave? Is it because they would bring news back from the front line?
I think you're absolutely right, Georgina. I think that is the worry. The Russian authorities have clamped down on any information that doesn't put across the official view that this is not a war but a special military operation, that the Russian army is liberating Russians in Ukraine, that they're fighting Nazis in Ukraine, they're now fighting NATO in Ukraine, all of which is nonsense. The only Nazis in Ukraine are Russian soldiers who behaved so atrociously. And so anything that actually brings the message back as happened again in Afghanistan. This was one of the things that the war in Afghanistan lasted for nearly 10 years. I said this for a long time, and I think it's generally accepted now, not just because I said it, but that the war in Afghanistan played a crucial role in the collapse of the Soviet Union. And one of the reasons was you had soldiers who'd serve out there who were being told they were doing their internationalist duty and then coming back and going back to their villages or towns all over Russia and saying, hey, they were shooting at us. You know, my friend got his arm blown off. And so when the horrors of war do come back, the Russians know from their experience from Afghanistan that this can have a knock-on effect, and it could really cause real trouble amongst the Russian population.
Stephen Deal, thank you very much indeed. You're with Monocle Radio.
UBS is a global financial services firm with over 150 years of heritage. Built on the unique dedication of our people, we bring fresh thinking and perspective to our work. We know that it takes a marriage of intelligence and heart to create lasting value for our clients. It's about having the right ideas, of course, but also about having one of the most accomplished systems and an unrivaled network of global experts. That's why at UBS, we pride ourselves on thinking smarter to make a real difference. Tune in to The Bulletin with UBS every week for the latest insights and opinions from UBS all around the world.
This is The Globalist on Monocle Radio with me, Georgina Godwin. It's 7:40 here in London. Peter Higgs, the Nobel Prize-winning physicist who discovered a new particle known as the Higgs boson, has died. He was 94. Higgs was awarded the Nobel Prize for Physics in 2013 for his work, which showed how the boson helped bind the universe together. Well, to look back at his life and legacy, I'm joined now by Dr. Chris Smith of the Naked Scientist podcast and a virologist at Cambridge University. Chris, we used to speak to you almost on a daily basis back in the good old days of COVID. We miss you.
Well, thank goodness, because that means COVID isn't such a problem.
Absolutely.
But I miss you too.
Chris, can you start by explaining to the likes of me, who are very ignorant on this, the particle Higgs boson and why it's important?
Well, Peter Higgs, who was born in Newcastle on Tyne 94 years ago and died on Monday, was a physicist. And in the 1960s, he was reading various bits of theoretical physics, because that was his field, theoretical physics. And he landed on a course of work which in 1964 led to the publication of two papers. Well, he submitted for publication, I should say, two papers, one of which was rejected. And it was rejected because the pair of them were literally a matter of lines long and a handful of equations. But the insight that was there was that they explained something that was missing in particle physics, which had enjoyed a real explosion in the 50s, 60s, 70s, because scientists began to assemble, or got close to assembling, what we call the Standard Model. When we look at the universe, we see that it's made up of particles, and those particles are made up themselves of particles that are smaller than they are, and they're bound together by various forces, and there are various ways of arranging all of this so that the system works. It's effectively like the spice rack in your kitchen wall of how you make matter. But there was one thing missing, which is that this could explain how matter worked, but it didn't explain where it got its mass from. In other words, when I put some of those spices and other things on the weighing scales, they register a weight. They've got mass, which when it's acted on by gravity has a weight. And what Peter Higgs's equations that were presented in those 1964 papers did was to convey away a notion that you could have a particle or a series of particles which would create a force field which would pervade the universe. And when things that had mass interacted, or things, particles that existed, interacted with that force field, they would feel that force and that would give them their mass. So this was the missing part of the explanation for why things weigh something when you put them on your weighing scales. And initially people said, well, it's just a theory. And many famous scientists said that this God particle should be called the goddamn particle because it'll never be discovered. It's too difficult. And even Stephen Hawking said, he bet another scientist $100 that it didn't exist. He even said to Peter Higgs about 20 years ago, I hope this is never discovered, because meaning he'd lose his bet, but also he just didn't think it was likely to be a reality. And Peter Higgs had retired a long time before they finally had enough power at the particle accelerator in CERN, the Large Hadron Collider, which could achieve the sorts of energies that you need by colliding protons, positive particles together, to create the sorts of disruptions in these fields and the sorts of particle decays that the theory predicted would only be seen if the Higgs boson and the field that these particles therefore create existed. And two independent experiments, which were done completely separate to each other at the LHC, both kept their data separate and brought it together on one day and said, look, we've independently both detected to a very high level of certainty the findings that would agree with what Peter Higgs's theory sets out. So he's probably right. And that's when they accepted in 2012. It was July the 4th, 2012, the Higgs boson, the particle he'd seen in, as a possibility in 1964, predicted, was real.
And so finally, what is his legacy? How does his work influence the life of ordinary people?
Well, I think the fact we're talking about it is one of the most powerful legacies. The fact that we understand why things have mass doesn't really matter to the average man, woman and child on the street at any second. But the fact we're talking about it, the fact that we're showing that this is what science can do, it brings us a step further along the path of explaining how the universe works and ultimately unlocking the power of other technologies yet to be discovered or harnessed. That's the real power of this. And I think the legacy is that A, he's got a particle named after him, which will never change in the history of humankind going forward, which is a pretty cool thing to have done. Mm. B, he's got a Nobel Prize, which is another pretty cool thing to have done. And we're talking about it and we'll continue to invoke this particle and this piece of physics from the 1960s for the rest of our lives and the lives of our children and so on.
Dr. Chris Smith, thank you very much indeed. Peter Higgs has died at the age of 94. Right, let's whiz you over to Australia. It's time to talk business with the national business reporter and presenter at ABC News, Rachel Papazzoni, who joins us now from Perth. Rachel, the Reserve Bank of New Zealand kept interest rates on hold today. When are they tipped to start cutting?
Yeah, no surprise to market watchers today, Georgina, when they held rates at 5.5%. They've been at that rate almost a year since May last year. The expectation is that they'll stay there for most of this year as well, UBS forecasting that that first rate cut probably not likely until November. And they expect, though, that the bank will then continue to cut every meeting through 2025 to get to a terminal rate of 3.75% by quarter four in 2025. New Zealand actually entered a technical recession in the last couple of weeks. They have inflation still very high at 4.7%, way off their target of 1 to 3% range. Unemployment still at 4%. So clearly a lot more work to do there, even though listeners may recall that the Bank of New Zealand was one of the first to start lifting the official interest rates back in 2021.
Right. And of course, they're not the only ones. The Bank of Canada's tipped to hold today, the European Central Bank tomorrow. Is this all about waiting to see what the US Fed does?
It really is. We're all sort of waiting to see how things play out in the US and then we'll likely respond to that. So the Bank of Canada at 5%, the European Central Bank at 4%, as you said, unlikely to change this week. What we'll get overnight, though, is the US inflation number, and that is going to be the biggest marker for what we may see the US Fed do when it meets at the end of this month and also on May 1 for day two of its meetings. At this stage, we're not expecting to see any change to interest rates in the US at its meeting later this month, but it does all depend on this inflation data due out later today or overnight my time. We've seen inflation in the US very, very sticky, in fact, dodging falls month to month the last few months and surprising to the upside. The US Fed Chair Jerome Powell said last week that it was too soon to say whether the recent readings represent more than just a bump in the sort of inflation story. But if it overshoots again this month, that has the potential to really see the market lose some patience and we may have to see some action from the US Fed. one of those big parts, of course, playing into inflation globally is oil prices. They continue to rise on the back of conflicts in the Middle East and in Europe. And reading just today, for example, that Mexico has announced cuts to its exports of oil. So many factors playing into one of the biggest drivers of inflation at the moment.
Now, South Korea is voting today. How important is the cost of living crisis for those voters in the election?
Just as it is for everyone in all the countries we've mentioned so far today, Georgina, inflation is still high in South Korea. It's at 3.1%. The interest rate there at 3.5%. Their bank meets on Friday, also unlikely to change. So 30% of voters have already cast their ballots in today's election. But what we've seen in the lead up to today is a lot of coverage of a disconnect between President Yoon and everyday Koreans who are facing these cost of living pressures that so many people around the world are familiar with. President Yoon is not up for re-election. He's into year three of his five-year term, but he came in 2022 vowing to cut taxes, ease business regulations, and expand family support for Koreans. And there's been a lot of discontent that a lot of those promises haven't been met. So analysts are pretty split on how things could fall in the election today. So there's still a few more hours until polls close in South Korea. But for Australia, it's a big trading partner for us. So we're keen to see how that all plays out. Of course, it's a big year of elections with the biggest one, of course, the US presidential race when voting there occurs in November.
Mm-hmm. Finally, let's have a look at EVs, electric vehicles. This has led to a record number of car-carrying ship orders. Tell us more about that.
Yeah, I guess it's just a great indication of how interconnected the global economy is. So we've seen, of course, a boom in EV demand. It has pared back a little bit and not sort of met expectations in the last few months, but still on that upward trajectory. And, of course, you've got to get those electric vehicles from where they're made, mostly in China, to the customer around the world. So China has increased its order for car-carrying vessels. Currently, it has 33 car-carrying ships, and it's put an order in for 47 more, so clearly more than doubling its current load. And if that does indeed take place by 2028, as expected, it'll become the fourth largest owner of car-carrying vessels, but still a long way to go compared to Japan. It's the world's largest. It has 283 car-carrying ships. Norway has 102. South Korea has 72. So China would become fourth after that list. And a lot of that buying is coming from car makers themselves. For example, EV giant BYD, it's put in orders for car-carrying ships. It exported more than 240,000 EVs last year. It expects to almost double that to 400,000 this year. So it needs to get those cars from China to the customer, as I explained, and that happens on ships.
I was recently in Australia and did see sort of parking lots full of these Chinese-built electric vehicles, but they were there in showrooms, not, you know, for sale. Are there a lot of them on the road there?
I definitely feel that we are starting to see a lot more. We're seeing a lot more Teslas as well, Georgina, but definitely particularly the BYD Build Your Dream branded car. I've seen a lot more of them, and I actually took one for a test drive a couple of months ago because I was interested just to see what it's all the hype is about. And they drive just as smoothly as the Tesla, and obviously at a lower price point, they're much more attainable for a larger portion of the population. Australia's biggest challenge, of course, though, isn't going anywhere, and that is the distance. We need a lot more charging stations dotted throughout the country to make EV uptake really surge here in Australia.
Rachel, thank you very much indeed. That's Rachel Papazzoni, and this is The Globalist on Monocle Radio. And finally today, the shortlist for the prestigious literary award, the International Booker Prize, has just been announced. In all, it spans 6 languages, 6 countries and 3 continents. So let's go through the shortlistees now with Ramesh Gunasekera, who's the award-winning author and a judge of the International Booker 2024. Ramesh, it's lovely to speak to you again. Run us through the shortlist and where the authors come from.
Hi, Georgina. Lovely to be here. Thanks for having me. So we've got a short list that, as you say, covers a lot of places. It's very varied. Not a River is an Argentinian novel. Kairos from Germany. The Details from Sweden. Meta 2-10 from South Korea. You were talking about Korea. What I'd rather not think about is the Dutch novel, and Crooked Plough from Brazil.
Mm-hmm. A lot of these are from independent publishers. I wonder why we see independent publishers making the list so often. The big houses don't feature nearly so much.
Yeah, it's an interesting one, I guess. And I think generally, looking at the submissions that we had for this prize, there are a lot of independent presses. And the reason for that, I really don't know, other than I guess there are more small presses coming up. Publishing a book is not as technically complicated as it used to be ages ago. And therefore, people are starting out, and I think they're interested in exploring different fiction.
And taking more risks, than the bigger publishing houses. You've been shortlisted for the Booker yourself. I think that was at 94. What difference does this kind of recognition make to a writer?
I think it makes a huge difference. I mean, the game, if you like, was different back in 94. It was a different sort of thing. We didn't have long lists. It was just a short list. And there is a difference between the Booker Prize and the International Booker Prize. Of course, the prize we're talking about now is for translated fiction, whereas the Booker Prize is for fiction written in English. And translated fiction, you know, has been growing in popularity, in exposure over the last few years. You know, back in the 90s, it would have been much more difficult to find, I suppose, whereas at the moment, as I understand it, it's the most sort of fastest growing area of fiction and fiction reading, certainly in certain groups of readers, particularly readers under the age, I think, of 35. Mm. So there's a real boom there, I think. And the reasons for that are interesting to look at, really.
And just finally, what are the challenges of judging books from such diverse places?
Well, it's a challenge, but it's also what's really, really interesting to me and what drew me to it when I was invited to do this. I thought it would be great because it's a chance to look at writing in other languages, other cultures, obviously translated into English, but it's carrying on that conversation that books are all about, but in a much wider context and across cultures. And I think for me, it's hugely eye-opening. It's great to see what people are writing, what fiction means in a different language, how you open it up. And for me as a reader, it's about bringing an open mind to it.
Ramesh, thank you so much. That's Ramesh Gunasekera. And if you'd like to know more about Ramesh's own work, there's a wonderful interview with him in our vast Meet the Writers archive, which you can find on our website. And also the winner of the International Booker Prize will be announced on the 21st of May. And that's all for today's programme. Thanks to our producers Sophie Monaghan-Coombs, Carlotta Ribello and Monica Lillis, our researcher George Ruskin and our studio manager Steph Chungu. After the headlines, there's more music on the way and The Briefing is live at midday in London. That's with me. I'm Georgina Godwin and I'll return on The Globalist at the same time tomorrow. Thank you for listening.